The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Just a quick word of explanation before the Bible is read, and that is, if you pick up a newspaper, you'll go through parts that are news and should be just kind of reporting what's happened and who said what. Then you'll run into a part where there might be editorials and sort of opinion pieces. Now, those things should be kept apart, but they're sometimes blurred. But they write quite differently about similar events. And then you might come, if it's a good paper, to a good comic. You know, a line drawing, people's characteristics accentuated. And sometimes that can bring you more insight or a stronger opinion than the, 500-word pieces. But they're different ways of communicating. You find them in the same book. Now, this is true of the Bible. In fact, it's true of the book of Daniel. Daniel starts off with the first six chapters are stories. They're chronicles. They're narrations of what happened to a few people. Adventures, most of them. Great stories. And but you'll find, as I just turn myself on here... Yeah, good. What? But when you get to chapter 7, the whole style of God's communication changes. It's what's known as apocalyptic literature. It's most famous from the book of Revelation, but it starts in the Old Testament. And it's wild dreams, beasts, visions, pictures, comic drawings it is. And they communicate to you at a different level, but it's the same basic message. And this one is one of the most famous chapters of apocalyptic. It's got beasts. It's got a picture of the throne of God. It's worth looking at what it says about God. And lastly, one of the most mysterious and most important figures in the whole of the Old Testament. There's only two verses about him, but he pops up when Jesus comes a lot, the Son of Man. So let's have a listen to this wild, enjoyable bit of apocalyptic.
It's basically the Bible in colour and 3D. Open up your programs and I'll read it from Daniel chapter 7, verses 1 through to 15. You don't have 15 on your programs, but I'm going to read it anyway. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and a human mind was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on its back it had four wings like those of a bird. This beast had four heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims, and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being, and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. he approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me.
I don't know if you have friends, or I used to have a member of my family who would regularly want to tell me her dreams. And the trouble with most dreams is that they're often fascinating for the person who has them, but frankly a little dull for those who listen to them. And I think psychiatrists deserve a high amount of money if they do get to listen to your dreams. But sometimes dreams can be just interesting or even amusing or sometimes terrifying. But every now and then God uses dreams to communicate to people. God can communicate to you however he wishes. It's his universe. You're his creature in his world. He can do whatever he likes. The question sometimes is to work out, is that God? Was that my liver playing up? Maybe even is it a demon? There's any sorts of possibilities. But sometimes God departs from his usual way. What is the usual way? Well, according to Jesus, the usual way God speaks is through his book. Does that sound dull to you? It's remarkably wonderful. Because there it is, fixed, written. If you think you misunderstood it, you can go back and read it. If you forget what he said, you can see it. Dreams have a tendency, don't they, to be forgotten or to be enhanced or important parts to be left out. But God normally speaks in this way, but will, when he chooses to, speak through dreams. So in parts of Africa, there is a huge movement of African men and women departing from Islam and becoming Christians. It's causing quite an alarm amongst some of the mullahs there, although some of the imams there have become Christians. And one of the organizations that works in that area, and God is using in this particular way, has recorded that 42% of those people from that part of Africa who are becoming Christian record that prior to becoming Christians, they have dreams and visions of Jesus. Some of them, and I've met people like this, who've had dreams as children and didn't know who the person was that spoke to them. But very often it's as adults. God will use dreams as he pleases. He chooses here, as you heard, to speak to his servant Daniel by means of dreams. Now the interesting thing here is that Daniel goes from being the dream interpreter, which we see him doing in chapters 2 and 4 and 5, to being the person who gets dreams and actually needs to have someone help him understand them. That's the part of Daniel 7 that we didn't read just through want of time. It's not that we don't like it, but you've got to stop somewhere so you can get back to work, which I know you're keen to do. So we stopped there when the dream part finished. He has a dialogue with someone else to try and get clear what the dream means. But here it is, the dreamer, who was once the interpreter of dreams. His position has changed. Now, one of the ways you can test if a dream comes from God or a sense or whatever is you always compare it with what God has said elsewhere. If you claim to have had a vision from God that says you can commit adultery, that's a satanic dream. It's a lie, forget it. It's out of your own subconscious. If you claim to have a dream that says you can kill someone, you can forget that dream too, because that has not come from the God and Father of Jesus Christ. Dreams can be and need to be tested. This particular dream is given to Daniel, but he writes it down. Why? Because this is not just a personal dream. This is a dream through which God will communicate to all of his people, so he writes it down, as he says in verse 2. He looked, and the dream begins. Now, you might have noticed, I asked Craig to read on beyond what was on the page there, the response that the dream has. See, there's a very, 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 very common view of religion, that the purpose of religion is to comfort you, is to soothe your way through life. It's like a pillow. And this is what I used to say to Christians. They're just psychological weaklings who need something to help them. What does this dream from God do to Daniel? Well, as you heard, and let me read you again verse 15. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me. The visions in my mind were alarming me. So this is not a soothing thing. This is more like an alarm clock. And what the dream will do is it is alarming. It is distressing in its horror, and it is also surprising in its beauty. And real Christianity is always in the bright major colours. It's not in pastels. It's alarmingly dark. It's surprisingly beautiful and powerful and overwhelming. And it's the truth. The truth is like that. It doesn't come from our head to comfort us. It's both exciting and troubling and wonderful. Christianity is much more like an amphetamine than it is like a barbiturate to put you to sleep. Because it reveals truth. We want truth, but we hate truth. We want some parts of the truth, but sometimes we have to look back and think, I really knew I shouldn't have done that, but I didn't face it. Or I really knew that person was dodgy, but the offer was so good. I shouldn't have sent all my money to Nigeria on that scam, you know, on the basis that some prince there was going to send all his money to me. I was a dope. I've heard people talk about this. I kind of knew it wasn't right, but I'm so greedy, I gave into it. Let's have a look at the question of truth from a very famous movie, one of my favourites, a moment that you'll probably recall. A Few Good Men.
You don't have to answer that question.
I'll answer the question. You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth! You can't handle the truth!
That's a great line, isn't it? I want the truth! You can't handle the truth! Now, that's just a movie. I want to suggest to you one of the problems with Christianity is the truths are too big, too powerful, too revolutionary. So we find 1,000 different silly excuses that often mutually destroy each other in order to just get back to a slightly duller, just to go back to being a little drowsy with a little spiritual insight. You can't handle the truth. Well, I hope you can handle it with me. Daniel could only barely handle it. So this is a dream that awakens dreamers. Secondly, let's have a look at the first part. We're going to travel reasonably quickly. It's the dream, the vision of the four hideous beasts. He starts off, it's troubling enough actually, it starts badly for a Jew, as Daniel is. Daniel chapter 2, verse 2. Daniel said, in my vision at night I looked and before me were four winds of heaven churning up the great sea. We would love to have a house by the sea if we could only afford it. People sell their souls to get a house by the sea. It's the purpose of life. Williamson, the Australian playwright, says, the purpose of life in Sydney is clear. It's to have a house with a water view. Even a unit. Even looking over that, just see a glimpse of the harbour. That's it. Jews not like that. They did not like the sea. They were not a maritime people. The sea was frightening. It was restless. It could be calm one day and mad the next. And it had big beasties that you could see sometimes swimming past. So when the sea, consistently in apocalyptic literature, is a place of seething, restless human evil. So it's not even a good place to start. And then it gets worse because coming out of it is this horrible, grotesque set of beasts. Four great beasts, each different from the other, came up out of the sea. The first one was like a lion. The second was like a bear. The third was like a leopard. The fourth is indescribably evil. They're all carnivorous animals. They're all animals that kill. They're all animals that tear you apart with their teeth. And it gets worse and worse and worse until you get to the fourth one where it's not like anything. It's not some sort of mutant beast. All these animals are mutants. They're a combination of various things. And they rage around the earth, rushing to and fro as the leopard does. And these clearly represent, well, is it clear what they represent? In case you're not sure, Daniel asks an angel of God afterwards. He says, you know, what are these beasts? Verse 17, you don't have it in front of you, but I'll read it to you honestly. The angel says, these great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings or kingdoms, which will arise from the earth. So these are four empires that he's talking about. Some discussion about what they are. It doesn't matter, I think, for today to work out what they are. And then it's finished up with the fourth beast. The only thing that says about the fourth beast is it draws attention to his teeth. And these are not just, you know, these things which are pretty tough. But these are metal teeth. Now, this is Robo-Beast. He has large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured. The angel in the second half of Daniel 7 will say it's got bronze claws. This is a terrifying picture. I don't know if you've seen movies like Alien. There's a series of them, the great movies, where Ellen Ripley, one of the great female characters of Hollywood, she fights womanfully against this horrible beast that's kind of metal, although it's born. And there's some terrible moments when this face of this thing, and all you really see is its teeth, are right up close to her. And you remember the softness of human flesh. I mean, particularly men, we like to think we're pretty tough, you know. We're not really. But when you've got metal teeth, that's a terrifying thing. The idea of being caught up between metal teeth, that's a gross image. And what is this about? Well, the angels told us what it's about. It's a picture of history. It's a warning to Daniel that although life's going okay for him, he's actually in the high levels of the public service. He's living, well, not like a king, but like a prince. He's doing okay. But he's told Daniel, the history of humankind is one beast supplanted by another beast, supplanted by another beast, supplanted by another beast. This is the history of humankind as God sees it. That out of the seething energy of humanity comes beast after beast after beast. If you're on the inside of the beast, it can feel relatively comfortable. But don't worry, that beast will be devoured by another beast. That's how it works in history. There are any number of tribal groups that invited a beast to help them against another beast. This is what happened at one famous part in Egyptian history. They invited a neighboring group to help them against the Byzantians, and they have in many ways regretted it since. Happened to the Incas, I think it was. One of those great... Why did the Spaniards defeat some of these great nations in South America? Because other nations rose up around them to help them against their ancient oppressor, only later on to deeply regret it, because the new oppressor was in many ways worse. Didn't tear your heart out, but did other things to you. That's what he's saying. The sad progression of human history is beast after beast after beast. One being replaced, always being replaced. The empires look so solid and so enduring, like the Third Reich that Adolf Hitler said that would be there for 1,000 years. I think it lasted 10. But my God, it was a beast, wasn't it? Coming from arguably the most civilized people with the finest universities and the most gorgeous classical music, and yet out of that culture comes, for a moment, a beast that was supposed to last for 1,000 years. It was gone in 10, thank God. So it's very similar to Daniel 2, isn't it? Which I'm sure you all remember when Al spoke of it a few weeks ago, if you were here. A similar thing of four progressive kingdoms. But in this one, in the vision that Nebuchadnezzar has in Daniel 2 that Daniel interprets for him, it's a beautiful glittering statue, golden head, silver body, working its way down in lesser but stronger metals as it goes. And this, see, because there's two ways you can look at empires, both present or past. There's a part of an empire that is magnificent, isn't it? I mean, empires build beautiful cities. Babylon was a gorgeous city. Rome, in its classical height, magnificent. London, you know, New York, Beijing, Sydney, you know, when we have our empire, right? But cities at the height of empire are gorgeous with art and architecture and... And that's what the statue... But the thing that Daniel 2 says is magnificent but temporary. Always gone in a flash. Always here, gone. But what Daniel 7 picks up is the other side of empire. The part that if you're at the heart of the empire, you often don't feel, and that is the grotesque, bloody slaughter and tyranny. Do not oppose the empire. Amongst the most civilized of human empires ever in human history, and I'm not a pomophile, is the English Empire. But the Indians have got a legitimate gripe that an enormous amount of the wealth that made England powerful was just ripped out of the heart of India. I mean, some of the crown jewels, the most spectacular one, even bears the name of India. That's what empires do. All of them. The American Empire, whatever will come next. And that this is saying, empires, though they build magnificent and beautiful things, are also bloody and cruel and savage to those who they oppress. This imperialistic drive. Well, that's history. That's a bit alarming. But the key thing is, if you want to get any sort of strong encouragement to endure and not to fall into despair and depression, is to keep looking. So that's what Daniel keeps doing. Verse 9. As I looked... Thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as wool. His clothing was white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming fire. It's not a very comforting picture. The wheels were all ablaze, and a river of fire was flowing, coming out before him. So amidst this horrible chaos on earth, coming out of the turbulent sea of human nature, he looks up and he continues, and there he sees... a vision, one of the few visions painted in the Bible of God himself. actually nothing much described about God himself at all. He's described in terms of a number of things. Firstly, he's given a name and a title, the Ancient of Days. This is in direct contrast to the ephemeral passing nature of human empires. God is the Ancient of Days, not signifying, as we might think in our silly youth-obsessed culture, old and tired and weary and, you know, just wasting the children's inheritance instead of dying gracefully and getting out of the way. Right? This is the sense of old, as most cultures see it, as the place, therefore, where wisdom lives, understanding, insight through years and years of experience. So the contrast of the Ancient of Days is the eternality of God. The childish question sometimes asked with the cultured language, well, who made God? Right? Sounds clever until you stop and think about it, right? God is the eternal one. There is nothing logically incoherent about a being that doesn't start. Might be hard in our little brains to fix, to get, but there's nothing logically impossible or incoherent about it at all. And God, as it says, as Moses says, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Go back as far as you like till time, well, until God begins time. That's his own creation that begins at the Big Bang, as far as we can tell. From everlasting to everlasting, he is God. Moses says, who are you? What's the name of God? This would be a good test for if a religion is true, if it's got the name of God right. Right? What does God say to Moses? I am who I am. Or I will be who I am. God is the great I am. He's always I am-ing. He's in the present tense now. He's in the present tense yesterday. He'll be in the present tense. Everything is the great eternal now for God. God is the Ancient of Days. He's clothed in white. This is in contrast to the impurity and the filth and the vileness that's in all government, all power, all authority. Power corrupts. The more power, the more corrupted. Except, thank God, in the throne of heaven where it's white. That's good, but the next part's a bit worrying. It's enthralling but appalling. The throne of God, imagine this, imagine seeing this, white, the eternal one, and the throne on which he sits, the place of his power, is burning fire, and yet God is unperturbed and unhurt. It burns, but it doesn't consume. The wheels, because it's immobile, it wants to let you know God is completely mobile. He's not fixed. There's no holy places in the Bible. There's no holy areas of ground. God is everywhere. But it destroys and burns up corruption. That's what it does, which is why it ultimately destroys empires. Well, there's the picture of God. He sees it. And here it's quiet. See, nothing is said there. It's all ordered and quiet, and it's all chaos and panic down here. But God, he's not panicked. He's in control. He has his plan. He has his program. He's working out his purposes, which will find their center in Jesus. Then there's a little reference down in verse 11 to the part of the fourth beast running around speaking, and in a moment God just brings it to an end, right? This is sort of echoing before it comes the book of Revelation, where, you know, in the book of Revelation there's these great pictures of huge battles, great armies getting together, and then it says Jesus just breathed on them and they died. It's very disappointing, really, expecting some great clash that will take at least an hour of the movie and it's over in a split second. This one upon the throne does not struggle to bring down the most powerful empires ever, as he showed again and again. So there we glance at the center, the fiery center of all things. Keep looking, though. Keep looking. And we'll hit the most mysterious couple of verses in the Bible, most mysterious ones in the Old Testament, and yet probably, perhaps, the most important two verses in the Old Testament, and yet verses that have for thousands of years puzzled the wise scholarly rabbis of the Jewish tradition. He sees the beasts, he sees the one upon the throne, then he sees someone else. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. And he approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. Now there's a serious argument that probably more scholarly books and articles have been written about those few words, the Son of Man, in Daniel 7, than any other part of the entire Old Testament. It is a very madness on the earth, a throne that is both wonderful and in control and yet a bit scary, and then this character comes up who approaches the throne. Now, we're told in 1 Timothy 6 that God dwells in unapproachable light, but this one just approaches God. Doesn't avert his gaze as the seraphim do, that sort of thing which the angels in heaven do. He just walks straight, as it were, eyeball to eyeball, unthinkable, if you know anything about the nature and the character of the living and true God. Who is this? Well, we're given a few hints. He comes on the clouds. Now, Psalm 104, Psalm 68, many parts in the Bible. The one who travels on the clouds, it's a poetic image of God. So this Son of Man is on the clouds, which is a bit puzzling. That's supposed to be someone else who, as it were, rides the clouds. And he's like you, but he's not like you. He's a Son of Man. Now, this is an interesting term. It pops up in the book of Ezekiel, one of the other prophets from the Old Testament, 87 times. And it has the sense of a human being. The phrase simply literally means a son of Adam, which those of you who love C.S. Lewis and have read the Narnia stories will know it's one of the names that Aslan gives the humans, sons of Adam, daughters of Eve. And it references our fragility and our createdness, but also, strangely, our inherent dignity as well. It's got both those things. So this is, but he's like a son of man. There's something Daniel can't quite. It's like a son, but it's like, it's not quite the same as us. So it's a man, but it's not, you know. Well, who's he talking about? Well, it's like one or two other weird places in the Bible. There's one of the prophets that speaks about God's fellow. Now God has no fellows, but there's this one verse in the Zechariah where it speaks of God's fellow. And again, the rabbis understand, can't make any sense of that. God has no fellow. But you move off to the New Testament and you find this interesting thing that Jesus does. Some of you will be aware of this, that Jesus' favorite term for himself, the reference he constantly used for himself, was not Messiah. He wouldn't use the word Messiah. He didn't deny it when people said, "Are you the Messiah?" He would agree to it. But he would always then flick it and go straight to another word. So when Peter works out he's the Messiah in Mark 8, Jesus goes straight away and talks about the Son of Man. When he gets asked in Mark on his trial before the high priests, you're not actually allowed to ask this sort of question in the Jewish trial, but they were getting fed up with Jesus. And so the chief magistrate misbehaved. He said, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" Jesus said, "I am." "Are you the Christ?" "I am." "Are you the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," he says. "I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming in the clouds of heaven." It is Jesus' favorite term for himself. He'll use it in public. He'll use it with his friends. He'll use it on his trial. No one else calls him the Son of Man in any of the Gospels. The only time anyone uses the word Son of Man of Jesus is the reference you've got there as the title for the fourth point, where in John 12, Jesus speaking about the Son of Man being lifted up on the cross and coming back from the dead, the Son of Man, the Son of Man. And they go, "Who is this Son of Man?" They can't work it out. And Jesus is saying, "It's me." In fact, there are phrases you can get from one Gospel where it'll be recorded, Jesus says, "The Son of Man." And another time, the same sort of phrase is used, "I." And why does he do this? Well, it's partly because here is a term that has not been corrupted. Here is a phrase that was so mysterious to the Jews that they didn't use it. They didn't know who it was. Jesus, "I'm it. Understand who the Son of Man is. You'll understand who I am." Now, I was in a debate some years ago with a very impressive friend of mine, a man called Mustafa, a very devout and a very fine guy. And Mustafa had invited me to be in a debate about Jesus. And there are sometimes in a discussion where you're so glad someone has brought up a particular point of attack, and he's saying, "You know, you've got to stop speaking out Jesus, the Son of God." His preferred term, and he gave the numbers, was not Son of God. He does use that sometimes, but Son of Man. He says, "You should speak of Jesus, the Son of Man. He's the Son of Man. He's just a man is all he is. He's the Son of Man. Why don't you speak like Jesus? Why don't you be a real disciple?" And it was a good debating point. Oh, so glad he brought it up. Because there were about 400 people in this little hall, most of them Muslims, most of them never heard anything from the Bible. And I was able to read the fact that all scholars know that this is a reference to Daniel 7. So I was able to read it to him. "Does this sound like a humble little man to you? Let me read you the first verse, then critically the last verse. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven." You know, Jesus mentions that in Mark 14. "He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence." Now this is what the Son of Man's about. "He was given authority, glory, sovereign power, All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, a dominion that will not pass away. His kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. This Son of Man will have a kingdom that will never end. Unlike Nebuchadnezzar, unlike Alexander the Great, unlike Caesar Augustus, unlike, his kingdom will endure forever. All nations of everyone is called to worship him. There's nothing humble about this claim. And if you're going to use Bible words, at least let the Bible then tell you what it means. And the Bible's clear who the Son of Man is. It's an extremely glorious, godlike. Who has in the Bible supreme power and a kingdom that lasts forever but God? Who in the Bible is to be given glory? God, and God alone. He will not share his glory except with the Son of Man, who has a throne beside him. This is the answer in the end. This is who Jesus is. And Daniel is shown that. I don't think Daniel actually knows much what's going on here. But he knows that there is the Ancient of Days on his throne. And he knows that the Son of Man will be given all power. Not the beasts in the end. They won't have the last word. They'll seem to, but they won't. They may kill many of the people who belong to the Son of Man, but they will themselves go the way of the sword. He who lives by the sword, Jesus says, dies by it. Empires will come and go. Some of them will be religious empires. But any empire that uses the sword shows its true nature. It's an empire of the beasts, no matter how religious it looks. Right? The kingdom of Jesus is the one where the Son of Man comes to lay down his life. Right? And yet he is the ruler and the Lord of all. So I think the call from the book is to dare to see like Daniel, to see that life will be troublesome. There'll be great moments in it. But history is just a procession of beasts. But in the end, there is a throne. And the person who's been given all authority is a Son of Man, approachable, though great in power. And that's why Jesus' final words before he goes back to be with his Father, before the clouds hide him and take him to this great moment, says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." Now, friends, there is no statement like that in religious literature from around the world of a human being saying, "All authority in heaven and on earth is mine." Right? And it's because he's the Son of Man. Right? And the call is to be like Daniel. It may cost you your life. It may cost you some friends. It may cost you promotion. It may cost you your job. But it's worth it because you are tied to the only thing that endures. And in the end, we all like to back winners. He who has the last laugh lasts longest. And the thing Jesus is saying, tie yourself to the Son of Man and you'll laugh forever. Here's the question. Why is the term Son of Man in small letters, not Son of Man with a capital S and a capital M to indicate more of a title? In the New Testament, doesn't Jesus call himself Son of Man with capital S, capital M, not Son of Man in small S, small M? Good question. In both the Hebrew and the Greek, in its earliest manuscripts, the one that we translate from, there are no capitals. So the capitals is an English invention that we do that for titles. It's an English thing. So it's not in the original text. Therefore, translators can go either which way with it. Jesus speaks in Aramaic, and one of the great things modern scholarship has done is they've done a lot of work going. It's written down in Greek, which is the obvious language to write the New Testament because it was the lingua franca. It was the language of trade. You might have been a Roman, you might have been a Babylonian, but you could speak Greek. It's a bit like Hausa in parts of Africa. Everyone has their own tribal language, but everyone can speak Hausa. And Greek was that language. So wisely, God had the New Testament written in Greek. It's not a language he particularly favours, but it was useful. But behind it, Jesus actually spoke in Aramaic. And one of the great things modern scholars have done is done a bit of fun working backwards to what Aramaic. And one of the things you see with Jesus' teaching is a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it's in poetry in Aramaic, which makes it much more memorable for the disciples. But the Greek translation, trying to get the sense of it, is actually the Son of the Man, is the way that the Greek always puts it, because it's the Son of Adam. It's trying to get a sense of the dignity of the title. But the significant thing is to work out with Jesus, to understand him in his own terms. He calls himself the Son of Man. And don't you love Harleys? But he calls himself the Son of Man. All scholars know he's talking about Daniel 7. And it's a huge title. And yet he says the Son of Man did not come to be served, which is so confusing because that's, in the end, he does get served. But he says he came to lay down his life. This is why you don't need to be terrified of this power, because in the end it's a power that loves and serves. It's the mark of his kingdom that it loves and dies rather than kills and murders.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.